The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When the will the world stop it listen? When will we all stop and see? He looks upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. Someone still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. There's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Greetings and welcome to Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and today we hear the latest words of NSA surveillance revelators Glenn Greenwald, late of the British Guardian newspaper, and Julian Assange, the publisher of WikiLeaks. They, along with many others, including cyber journalist Jacob Applebaum and Sarah Harrison, the WikiLeaks liaison to exiled NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, were among the presenters at the just-concluded 30th Annual Chaos Communications Conference in Hamburg, Germany, attended by nearly 10,000 digital activists, corporate researchers, and, presumably, government observers. We begin with a teleconferenced appearance from the Ecuadorian embassy in London by Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, whose communications appear to have been blocked or overloaded several times through either external interference or bandwidth overload. The pauses, dropouts, and interruptions have been edited out for this Earthwatch broadcast of the 30C3 panel titled Sysadmins of the World Unite, featuring Sarah Harrison, Jacob Applebaum, and, of course, Julian Assange, speaking of what he calls the new global information apartheid.
Good evening. My name is Sarah Harrison, as you all appear to know. I'm a journalist working for WikiLeaks. This year I was part, as Jacob just said, of the WikiLeaks team that saved Snowden from a life in prison. This act and my job has meant that our legal advice is that I do not return to my home, the United Kingdom, due to the ongoing terrorism investigation there in relation to the movement of Edward Snowden documents. The UK government has chosen to define disclosing classified documents with an intent to influence government behaviour as terrorism. I'm therefore currently remaining in Germany. But it's not just myself personally that has legal issues at WikiLeaks. For a fourth Christmas, our editor Julian Assange continues to be detained without charge in the UK. He's been granted formal political asylum by Ecuador due to the threat from the United States, but in breach of international law, the UK continues to refuse to allow him his legal right to take up this asylum. In November of this year, a US government official confirmed that the enormous grand jury investigation, which commenced in 2010, into WikiLeaks, its staff, and specifically Julian Assange, continues. This was then confirmed by the spokesperson of the prosecutor's office in Virginia. The Icelandic parliament held an inquiry earlier this year where it found that the FBI had secretly and unlawfully sent 9 agents to Iceland to conduct an investigation into WikiLeaks there. Further secret interrogations took place in Denmark and Washington. The informant they were speaking with has been charged with fraud and convicted on other charges in Iceland. In the Icelandic Supreme Court, we won a substantial victory over the extra-legal US financial blockade that was erected against us in 2010 by Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and other US financial giants. Subsequently, MasterCard pulled out of the blockade. We've since filed a $77 million legal case against Visa for damages. We filed a suit against Visa in Denmark as well, and in response to questions about how PayPal's owner can start a free press outlet whilst blocking another media organisation, he's announced that the PayPal blockade of WikiLeaks has ended. Sorry, that wasn't meant to be a pause for a clap, I just needed some water, sorry. We filed criminal cases in Sweden and Germany in relation to the unlawful intelligence activity against us there, including at the CCC in 2009. Together with the Center for Constitutional Rights, we filed a suit against the US military against the unprecedented secrecy applied to Chelsea Manning's trial. Yet through these attacks, we have continued our publishing work. In April of this year, we launched the Public Library of US Diplomacy, the largest and most comprehensive searchable database of US diplomatic cables in the world. This coincided with our release of 1.7 million US cables from the Kissinger period. We launched our third spy files, 249 documents from 92 global intelligence contractors, exposing their technology, methods, and contracts. We completed releasing the global intelligence files, over 5 million emails from US intelligence firm Stratfor, the revelations from which included documenting their spying on activists around the globe. We published the primary negotiating positions for 14 countries of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a new international legal regime that would control 40% of the world's GDP. As well as getting Snowden asylum, we set up Mr. Snowden's Defence Fund, part of a broader endeavour, the Journalistic Source Protection Defence Fund, which aims to protect and fund sources in trouble. This will be an important fund for future sources, especially when we look at the US crackdown on whistleblowers like Snowden and alleged WikiLeaks source Chelsea Manning, who was sentenced this year to 35 years in prison, and another alleged WikiLeaks source, Jeremy Hammond, who was sentenced to 10 years in prison this November. These men, Snowden, Manning, and Hammond, are prime examples of a politicized youth who have grown up with a free internet and want to keep it that way. It is this class of people that we are here to discuss this evening, the powers they and we all have and can have, and the good that we can do with it. I am joined here tonight for this discussion by two men I admire hugely. Hopefully one of them will appear soon. WikiLeaks Editor-in-Chief Julian Assange and Jacob Applebaum, both who have had a long history in defending our right to knowledge despite political and legal pressure. There he is. So, Julian, seeing as I haven't seen you for quite a while, what's been happening in this field this year? What's your strategic view about it, this fight for freedom of knowledge? Are we winning or are we losing?
Well, I have an 18-page speech on the strategic vision, but I think I've got about 5 minutes, right?
The most.
No, less? Okay. Well, first off, it's very interesting to see the CCC has grown by 30% over last year. And we can see the CCC as a very important type of institution.
And so we've identified the potential, the people that you're talking about, or you've spoken about how it's good for them to unite. What are the next steps? How do they come forth? How do they share this information?
Well, let's consider a couple of things. First is that Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, Daniel Ellsberg, still Daniel Ellsberg, Edward Snowden, living in exile in Russia, unfortunately.
Still Edward Snowden.
Still Edward Snowden, hopefully. These are people who have taken great actions where they did not even set out to sacrifice themselves. But once when I met Daniel Ellsberg, he said, "Wouldn't you go to prison for the rest of your life to end this war?" This is something he asked me, and he asked it to me quite seriously. And it's very incredible to be able to ask a hypothetical question of someone. That wasn't a hypothetical question. What he was trying to say is that right now you can make a choice in which you can actually have a huge impact should you choose to take on that risk. But the point is not to set out to martyr yourself. The point is to set out. Are you going to stick around this time, Julian?
I don't know. I'm waiting for the quantum hand, Jake.
The quantum hand that wants to strangle you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we were just discussing right now the previous context, that is, Daniel Ellsberg, the Edward Snowdens, the Chelsea Mannings, how they have done an honorable, a good thing, where they have shown a duty to a greater humanity, a thing that is more important than loyalty, for example, to a bureaucratic oath, but rather loyalty to universal principles. So the next question is, how does that relate to the people that are here in the audience? How is it that the case that people who have access to systems where they have said themselves they think the companies they work for are sort of questionable or doing dangerous things in the world? Where do we go from people who have done these things previously to these people in the audience?
Well, okay, I don't know how much ground you covered, but I think it's important that we recognize what we are and what we have become, and that high-tech workers are a class. In fact, very often it's class A class, but in a position to, in fact, control the levers of society, from the NSA's CIA tax, would cease operating tomorrow.
Should we just leave him like that and continue?
Yeah.
Am I back?
Yeah. You've got 3 minutes to say something.
All right.
Make it good.
Those high-tech workers, we are a particular class, and it's time that we recognized that we are a class and looked back in history and understood that the great gains in human rights and education and so on that were gained through powerful industrial workers, which form the backbone of the economy of the 20th century, that we have that same ability. But even more so, because of the greater interconnection that exists now economically and politically, which is all underpinned by system administrators. And we should understand that system administrators are not just those people who administer one Unix system or another. They are the people who administer systems. And the system that exists globally now is created by the interconnection of many individual systems. And we are all, or many of us, are part of administering that system and have extraordinary power in a way that is really an order of magnitude different to the power industrial workers had back in the 20th century. And we can see that in the cases of the famous leaks that WikiLeaks has done, or the recent Edward Snowden revelations. It is possible now for even a single system administrator to have a very significant change to the, or rather apply a very significant constraint, a constructive constraint to the behavior of these organizations, not merely wrecking or disabling them, not merely going out on strikes to change policy, but rather shifting information from an information apartheid system, which we're developing from those with extraordinary power and extraordinary information, into the knowledge commons, where it can be used to not only as a disciplining force, but it can be used to construct and understand the new world that we're entering into. Now, Hayden, the former director of the CIA and NSA, is terrified of this. In Cypherpunks, we called for this directly last year, but to give you an interesting quote from Hayden, possibly following up on those words of mine and others, we need to recruit from Snowden's generation, says Hayden. We need to recruit from this group because they have the skills that we require. So the challenge is how to recruit this talent while also protecting ourselves from the small fraction of the population that has this romantic attachment to absolute transparency at all costs. And that's us, right? So what we need to do is spread that message and go into all those organizations. In fact, deal with them. I'm not saying don't join the CIA. No, go and join the CIA. Go in there, go into the ballpark and get the ball and bring it out with the understanding, with the paranoia that all those organizations will be infiltrated by this generation, by an ideology that is spread across the internet, and every young person is educated on the internet. There will be no person that has not been exposed to this ideology of transparency and understanding of wanting to keep the internet, which we were born into, free. This is the last free generation. The coming together of the systems of governments, the new information apartheid across the world, the linking together, is such that none of us will be able to escape it in just a decade. Our identities will be coupled to it, the information sharing is such that none of us will be able to escape it. We are all becoming part of the state, whether we like it or not. So our only hope is to determine what sort of state it is that we are going to become part of, and we can do that by looking and being inspired by some of the actions that produced human rights and free education and so on, by people recognizing that they were part of the state, recognizing their own power, and taking concrete and robust action to make sure they lived in the sort of society that they wanted to, and not in a hellhole dystopia.
Thank you. So basically all those poor people Jake just made identify themselves. You have the power to change more systems than the one you're working on right now. And I think it's time to take some questions because we don't have long left.
While we wait for the first question, you should all know that due to the various sorts of proximity measures that are now employed by NSA, GCHQ and Five Eyes Alliance, if you've come there with a telephone, or if you've been even in Hamburg with a telephone, you are all now coupled to us. You are coupled to this event. You are coupled to this speech in an irrevocable way. And that is now true for many people. So either we have to take command of the position that we have, understand the position we have, understand that we are the last three free people and the last people essentially with an ability to act in a situation. Or we are the group that will be crushed because of this association.
What is it that you feel like you can do? And many people that are in this audience, I've had this discussion with them. For example, Edward Snowden did not save himself. I mean, he obviously had some ideas, but Sarah, for example, not as a system administrator, but as someone who was willing to risk her person. She helped as a source, specifically for source protection. Very simply, what is it that you feel like you can do? And many people that are in this audience, I've had this discussion with them. For example, Edward Snowden did not save himself. I mean, he obviously had some ideas, but Sarah, for example, not as a system administrator, but as someone who was willing to risk her person. She helped as a source, specifically for source protection, she took actions to protect him. So there are things that can be done to help him even now. And there are things to show that if we can succeed in saving Edward Snowden's life and to keep him free, that the next Edward Snowden will have that to look forward to. And if we look also to what has happened to Chelsea Manning, we see additionally that Snowden has clearly learned, just as Thomas Drake and Bill Binney sets an example for every single person about what to do or what not to do. It's not just about system administrators, it's about all of us actually recognizing that positive contribution that each of us can make.
Okay, our next question will be microphone four, two, please.
Hi, Julian. I'm wondering, do you believe that transparency alone is enough to inject some form of conscience into evil organizations, so quote-unquote evil organizations? And if not, what do you believe the next step after transparency is?
It's not about injecting conscience. It's about providing two things. One, an effective deterrent to particular forms of behavior, and two, finding that information which allows us to construct and order the world around us, to educate ourselves in how the world works and therefore be able to manage the world that we are a part of. The restriction of information, the restriction of those bits of information colors it. It gives off an economic signal that information is important when it's released, because otherwise why would you spend so much work in restricting it? So the people who know it best restrict it. We should take their measurements of that information as a guide and use that to pull it out where it can achieve some kind of reform. That in itself is not enough. It creates an intellectual commons, which is part of our mutual education. But we need to understand, say, if we look at the Occupy event, a very interesting political event, where revelations and perhaps destabilization led to a mass, a very large group of people wanting to do something. However, there was no organizational scaffold for these people to attach themselves to, no nucleus for these people to crystallize onto. And it is that problem, which is an endemic problem of the anarchist left, actually. The CCC, why are we having this right now? Because the CCC is an organized structure. It's a structure which has been able to grow to accommodate the 30% of extra people that have occurred this year, to shift and change and act like one of the better workers' universities that are around. So we have to form unions and networks and create programs and organizational structures. And those organizational structures can also be written in code. Bitcoin, for example, is an organizational structure that creates an intermediary between people. It sets up rules between people. It may end up as a quite totalitarian system one day. Who knows? But at the moment, it provides some kind of balancing. So code and human structures do things. WikiLeaks was able to rescue Edward Snowden because we are an organized institution with collective experience.
That was Julian Assange, along with Jacob Applebaum and Sarah Harrison, speaking at the just-completed Chaos Communications Conference in Hamburg, Germany. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And up next, the keynote address of Glenn Greenwald, late of The Guardian. Greenwald is the lead reporter of the stunning revelations of the United States government's total information awareness regime, as revealed by exiled former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
My reaction when I learned that I had been asked to deliver the keynote to this conference was probably similar to the one that some of you had, which was, wait, what? You know, the reason is that my cryptographic and hacker skills are not exactly world-renowned. You know, the story has been told many times of how I almost lost the biggest national security story in the last decade, at least because I found the installation of PGP to be insurmountably annoying and difficult. And there's another story that's very similar that illustrates the same point that I actually don't think has been told before, which is prior to my going to Hong Kong, I spent many hours with both Laura Poitras and Edward Snowden trying to get up to speed on the basics of security technology that I would need in order to report on this story. And they tried to tutor me in all sorts of programs and finally concluded that the only one, at least at that time for that moment, that I could handle was TrueCrypt. And they taught me the basics of TrueCrypt, and I went to Hong Kong, and before I would go to sleep at night, I would play around with TrueCrypt, and I kind of taught myself a couple of functions that they hadn't even taught me, and really had all this sort of confidence. And on the third or fourth day, I went over to meet both of them, and I was beaming with pride, and I showed them all the new things that I had taught myself how to do on TrueCrypt, and I pronounced myself this cryptographic master that I was really becoming advanced. And I looked at both of them, and I didn't see any return pride coming my way. Actually, what I saw was them trying very hard to avoid rolling their eyes out of their head at me to one another. And I said, why are you reacting that way? Why isn't that a great accomplishment? And they sort of let some moments go by and no one wanted to break it to me. And finally Snowden piped in and said, TrueCrypt is really meant for your little kid brother to be able to master. It's not all that impressive. And I remember being very deflated and kind of going back to the drawing board. Well, you know, that was 6 months ago. And in the interim, the importance of security technology and privacy technology has become really central to everything it is that I do. I really have learned an enormous amount about both its importance and how it functions. And I'm far from the only one. I think one of the most significant outcomes of the last 6 months, but one of the most under-discussed, is how many people now appreciate the importance of protecting the security of their communications. If you go and look at my inbox from July, probably 3 to 5% of the emails I received were composed of PGP code. That percentage is definitely above 50% today and probably well above 50%. When we talked about forming our new media company, we barely spent any time on the question. It was simply assumed that we were all going to use the most sophisticated encryption that was available to communicate with one another. And I think most encouragingly, whenever I'm contacted by anyone in journalism or activism or any related fields, they either use encryption or are embarrassed and ashamed that they don't and apologize to me for the fact that they don't and vow that they're soon going to. And it's really a remarkable sea change, even from the middle of last year when I would talk to some of the leading national security journalists in the world who were working on some of the most sensitive information, and virtually none of them even knew what PGP or OTR or any other of the leading privacy technologies were, let alone how to use them. And it's really encouraging to see this technology spreading so pervasively. And I think that this underscores an extremely important point and one that gives me great cause for optimism. I'm often asked whether I think that the stories that we've been learning over the last 6 months and the reporting and the debates that have arisen will actually change anything and impose any real limits on the US surveillance state. And typically when people think the answer to that question is yes, the thing that they cite most commonly is probably the least significant, which is that there's going to be some kind of debate and our representatives in democratic government are going to respond to our debate and they're going to impose limits with legislative reform. None of that is likely to happen to reform themselves through symbolic gestures, while at the same time doing very little other than placating citizen anger and often increasing their own powers that created the scandal in the first place. We saw that in the mid-1970s when there was serious concern and alarm in the United States, at least as much there is now, if not more so, over the US government surveillance capabilities and abuse. And what the US government did in response is they said, well, we're going to engage in all these reforms that will safeguard these powers. We're going to create a special court that the government needs to go to get permission before they can target people with surveillance. And that sounded great, but then they created the court in the most warped way possible. It's a secret court where only the government gets to show up, where only the most pro-national security judges are appointed. And so this court gave the appearance of oversight when in reality it's the most grotesque rubber stamp that is known to the Western world. They almost never disapprove of anything. It simply created the appearance that there was judicial oversight. Or they also said, we're going to create congressional committees, the intelligence committees, that are going to have as their main function overseeing the intelligence committees and making certain that they no longer abuse their power. And what they did instead was immediately install the most servile loyalists of the intelligence committees as head of this quote unquote oversight committee. And that's been going on for decades, and today we have two of the most slavish, pro-NSA members of Congress as the head of these committees, who are really there to bolster and justify everything and anything the NSA does rather than engage in real oversight. So again, it's designed to prettify the process while bringing about no real reform. And this process is now repeating itself. You see the president appoint a handful of his closest loyalists to this independent White House panel that pretended to issue a report that was very balanced and critical of the surveillance state, but in reality introduced a variety of programs that at the very best would simply make these programs slightly more palatable from a public perspective and in many cases intensify the powers of the surveillance state rather than reining them in any meaningful way. So the answer to whether or not we're going to have meaningful reform definitely does not lie in the typical processes of democratic accountability that we're all taught to respect, but they do lie elsewhere. It is possible that there will be courts that will impose some meaningful restrictions by finding that the programs are unconstitutional. It's, I think, much more possible that other countries around the world who are truly indignant about the breaches of their privacy security will band together and create alternatives, either in terms of infrastructure or legal regimes that will prevent the United States from exercising hegemony over the internet or make the cost of doing so far too high. I think even more promising is the fact that large private corporations, internet companies, and others will start finally paying a price for their collaboration with this spying regime. And we've seen that already when they've been dragged into the light and finally now are forced to account for what it is that they're doing and to realize that their economic interests are imperiled by the spying system, exercising their unparalleled power to demand that it be reined in. I think all of those things are very possible as serious constraints on the surveillance state. But I ultimately think that where the greatest hope lies is with the people in this room and the skills that all of you possess. The privacy technologies that have already been developed, the Tor browser, PGP, OTR, and a variety of other products, are making real inroads in preventing the US government and its allies from invading the sanctity of our communications. None of them is perfect, none of them is invulnerable, but they all pose a serious obstacle to the US government's ability to continue to destroy our privacy. And ultimately, the battle over internet freedom, the question of whether or not the internet will really be this tool of liberation and democratization, or whether it will become the worst tool of human oppression in all of human history, will be fought out, I think, primarily on the technological battlefield. The NSA and the US government certainly knows that. That's why Keith Alexander gets dressed up in his little costumes, his dad jeans, and his edgy black shirt, and goes to hacker conferences. And it's why corporations in Silicon Valley like Palantir Technologies spend so much effort depicting themselves as these kind of rebellious pro-civil libertarian factions, as they spend most of their time in secret working hand in hand with the intelligence community and the CIA to increase their capabilities, because they want to recruit particularly younger brain power onto their side, the side of destroying privacy and putting the internet to use for the world's most powerful factions. And what the outcome of this conflict is, what the internet ultimately becomes, really is not answerable in any definitive way now. It depends so much on what it is that we as human beings do. And one of the most pressing questions is whether people like the ones who are in this room and the people who have the skills that you have now and in the future will succumb to those temptations and go to work for the very entities that are attempting to destroy privacy around the world, or whether you will put your talents and skills and resources to defending human beings from those invasions and continuing to create effective technologies to protect our privacy. And I'm very optimistic because that power does lie in your hands. So I want to talk about another cause of optimism that I have, which is that the pro-privacy alliance is a lot healthier and more vibrant. It's a lot bigger and stronger than I think a lot of us, even who are in it, often appreciate and realize. And even more so, it is rapidly growing. And I think inexorably growing. I know for me personally, every single thing that I have done over the last 6 months on this story and all of the platforms I've been given, like this speech and the honors that I've received and the accolades that I've been given, are ones that I share completely with two people who have been critically important to everything that I've done. One of them is my unbelievably brave and incomparably brilliant collaborator, Laura Poitras. And, you know, Laura doesn't get a huge amount of attention, which is how she likes it. But she really does deserve every last recognition and honor and award, because although it sounds cliche, it really is the case that without her, none of this would have happened. We have talked every single day virtually over the last 6 months. We have made almost every decision, certainly every significant one, in complete partnership and collaboration. And being able to work with somebody who has that high level of understanding about internet security, about strategies for protecting privacy, has been completely indispensable to the success of what we've been able to achieve. And then the second person who has been utterly indispensable, deserves every last accolade and to share in every last award, is my Laura's source, Edward Snowden. It is really hard to put into words what a profound effect his choice has had on me and on Laura and on the people with whom we've worked directly and on people with whom we've indirectly worked, and then millions and millions of people around the world. The courage and the principled act of conscience that he displayed will shape and inspire me for the rest of my life, and will inspire, I'm convinced, millions and millions of people to take all sorts of acts that they might not have taken because they've seen what good for the world can be done by even a single individual. And But I think it's so important to realize, and this to me is the critical point, is that none of us, the three of us, did what we did in a vacuum. We were all inspired by people who have done similar things in the past. I'm absolutely certain that Edward Snowden was inspired in all sorts of ways by the heroism and self-sacrifice of Chelsea Manning. And I'm quite certain that in one way or another, she, Chelsea Manning, was inspired by the whole litany of whistleblowers and other people of conscience who came before her to blow the whistle on extreme levels of corruption, wrongdoing, and illegality among the world's most powerful factions. And they, in turn, were inspired, I'm certain, by the person who is one of my greatest political heroes, Daniel Ellsberg, who did this 40 years ago. And even beyond that, there, I think it is really important to realize that everything that has been allowed to happen over the last 6 months, and I think any kind of significant leak and whistleblowing of classified information in the digital age, both past and current and future, owes a huge debt of gratitude to the organization which really pioneered the template, and that's WikiLeaks. And, you know, we didn't completely copy to the letter the model of WikiLeaks. We modified it a little bit, just like WikiLeaks modified what it has decided were its best tactics and strategies as it went along. And I'm sure people who come after us will modify what we have done to improve on what we have done and to avoid some of our mistakes and some of the attacks that have actually been successful. But I think the point that is really underscored here, and it was underscored for me probably most powerfully when Edward Snowden was rescued from Hong Kong from probable arrest and imprisonment for the next 30 years by the United States, not only by WikiLeaks, but by an extraordinarily courageous and heroic woman, Sarah Harrison. There's a huge network of human beings around the world who believe in this cause, and not only believe in it, but are increasingly willing to devote their energies and their resources and their time and to sacrifice for it. And the reason that there's a reason that's remarkable, and it kind of occurred to me in a telephone call that I had with Laura probably 2 months or so ago. Although we've communicated every day, we've almost never communicated by telephone. And one of the few exceptions was we were going to speak to an event at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we got on the phone and the night before to sort of talk about what ground she would cover and what ground I would cover. And what she said to me is, you know, it's amazing if you think about it. She went through the list of the people who have devoted themselves to transparency and the price that they've paid. And she said Edward Snowden is stuck in Russia facing 30 years in prison. Chelsea Manning is in prison. Aaron Schwartz committed suicide. People like Jeremy Hammond, and Barrett Brown are the subject of grotesquely overzealous prosecutions by virtue of the acts of transparency they've engaged in. Even people like Jim Risen, who is with an organization like the New York Times, faces the possibility of prison for the stories that he's published. Laura and I have been advised by countless lawyers that it's not safe for us to even travel to our own country. And she said, it's really a sign of how sick our political culture has become, that the price for bringing transparency to the government and for doing the job of the media and the Congress that they're not doing is these extreme forms of punishment. And, you know, she was right, and she had a good point, and I had a hard time disagreeing with it. I think anybody would, but I said, you know, there actually is another interesting point that list revealed. The thing that's so interesting to me about that list is that it's actually as long as it is, and it keeps growing. And the reason why that's so amazing to me is because the reason that people on that list and others like them pay a price is because the United States knows that its only hope for continuing to maintain its regimen of secrecy, behind which it can engage in those radical and corrupt acts, is to intimidate and deter and threaten people who are would-be whistleblowers and transparency activists from coming forward and doing what it is they do by showing them that they will be subjected to even the most extreme punishments, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And it's an effective tactic. You know, it is an effective tactic. It works for some people, not because those people are cowardly, but because they're rational. It really is the case that the United States and the British government not only are willing but able to essentially engage in any conduct, no matter how grotesque, no matter how extreme, no matter how lawless, with very little opposition that they perceive is enough to make them not want to do it. And so there are activists who rationally conclude that it's not worth the price for me to pay in order to engage in that behavior. That's why they continue to do it. But the paradox is that there are a lot of other people, I think even more people, who react in exactly the opposite way. When they see the US and the UK government showing their true face, showing the extent to which they're willing to abuse their power, they don't become scared or deterred. They become even more emboldened. And the reason for that is that when you see that these governments are really capable of that level of abuse of power, you realize that you can no longer in good conscience stand by and do nothing. It becomes an even greater imperative for you to come forward and shine a light on what they're doing. And if you listen to any of those whistleblowers or activists, they'll all say the same thing. It was a slow process to realize that the acts in which they were engaging were justified, but they were finally convinced of it by the actions of these governments themselves. And it's a really sweet irony. And I think it caused serious optimism that it is the United States and its closest allies who are sowing the seeds of dissent, who are fueling the fire of this activism with their own abusive behavior. Now, speaking of the attempt to intimidate and deter and the like, I just want to spend a few minutes talking about the current posture of the United States government with regard to Edward Snowden. It's become extremely clear at this point that the U.S. government at the highest levels on down is completely committed to pursuing only one outcome. And that outcome is one where Edward Snowden ends up spending several decades, if not the rest of his life, in a small cage, probably cut off in terms of communication from the rest of the world. And the reason why they're so intent on doing that is not hard to see. It's not because they're worried that society needs to be protected from Edward Snowden and from him repeating these actions. I think it's probably a pretty safe bet that Edward Snowden's security clearance is more or less permanently revoked. The reason they're so intent on it is because they cannot allow Edward Snowden to live any sort of a decent and free life because they're petrified that that will inspire other people to follow his example and to be unwilling to maintain this bond of secrecy when maintaining that bond does nothing but hides illegal and damaging conduct from the people who are most affected by it. And what I find most amazing about that is not that the United States government is doing that, that's what they do, it's who they are. What I find amazing about it is that there are so many governments around the world, including ones that are capable of protecting his human rights and who have been the biggest beneficiaries of his heroic revelations, who are willing to stand by and watch his human rights be crushed and be imprisoned for the crime of showing the world what's being done to their privacy. It has really been startling to watch governments, including some of the largest in Europe, and their leaders go out in public and express intense indignation over the fact that the privacy of their citizens is being systematically breached, and genuine indignation when they learn that their privacy has also been targeted. And yet, at the same time, the person who sacrificed in order to defend their basic human rights, their rights of privacy, is now having his own human rights targeted and threatened in recrimination. And I realize that for any country like Germany or France or Brazil or any other country around the world to defy the dictates of the United States, that there's a cost to doing that. But there was an even greater cost to Edward Snowden to come forward and do what he did in defense of your rights, and yet he did it anyway. And I think that what's really important to realize is that countries have the legal and the international obligation by virtue of treaties that they've signed to defend Edward Snowden from political persecution and prevent him from being in cage for the rest of his life for having shown a light on systematic abuses of privacy and other forms of abuses of secrecy. But they also have the ethical and moral obligation as the beneficiaries of his actions to do what he did for them, which is to protect his rights in return. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about one of my favorite topics, which is journalism. When I was in Hong Kong and with Laura and Ed Snowden, I've been reflecting on this a lot in the course of writing the book that I've been writing over the past couple months about everything that's happened. One of the things I realized in looking back on that moment and also in talking to Laura about what took place there was that we spent at least as much time talking about issues relating to journalism and a free press as we did talking about surveillance policy. And the reason is that we knew that what we were about to do would trigger as many debates over the proper role of journalists vis-a-vis the state and other power factions as it would the importance of internet freedom and privacy and the threat of the surveillance state. And we knew in particular that one of our most formidable adversaries was not simply going to be the intelligence agencies on which we were reporting and who we were trying to expose, but also their most loyal, devoted servants, which calls itself the United States and British media. And so we spent a great deal of time strategizing about it. We resolved that we were going to have to be very disruptive of the status quo, not only the surveillance and political status quo, but also the journalistic status quo. And I think one of the ways that you can see what it is that we were targeting is in the behavior of the media over the past 6 months as these revelations have emerged almost entirely without them and despite them. One of the more remarkable things that has happened to me is I gave an interview 3 weeks or so, or a month ago, on BBC. And it was on this program called Hard Talk. And I, at one point, had made what I thought was the very unremarkable and uncontroversial observation that the reason why we have a free press is because national security officials routinely lie to the population in order to shield their power and to get their agenda advanced, and that the goal and duty of a journalist is to be adversarial to those people in power, and that the pronouncements that this interviewer was citing about how these government programs are critical to stopping terrorists should not be believed unless there's actual evidence shown that they're actually true. And he interrupted. When I said that, he interrupted me and he said, look, I'm sorry, I don't do pompous British accents well, so you'll just have to transpose it in your own imagination onto what I'm saying. But he said, you know, I just need to stop you. You have said something so remarkable. He was like a Victorian priest scandalized by seeing a woman pull up her skirt a little bit above her ankles. He said, I just cannot believe that you would suggest that senior officials, generals in the United States and the British government are actually making false claims to the public. How can you possibly? No, and that is not aberrational. It really is the central view of certainly American and British media stars, that when especially people with medals on their chest who are called generals, but also high officials in the government make claims, that those claims are presumptively treated as true without evidence, and that it's almost immoral to call them into question or to question their veracity. And obviously, we went through the Iraq War, in which those two same governments specifically and deliberately lied repeatedly to the government, to their people, over the course of 2 years to justify an aggressive war that destroyed a country of 26 million people. But we've seen it continuously over the last 6 months as well. The very first document that Edward Snowden ever showed me was one that he explained would reveal unquestionable lying by the senior national intelligence official of President Obama, the director of national intelligence, James Clapper. That was the document that revealed that the Obama administration had succeeded in convincing a court, a secret court, to compel phone companies to turn over to the NSA every single phone record of every single telephone call, local and international, of every single American, even though that national security official, James Clapper, before the Senate just months earlier was asked, does the NSA collect bulk data about the communications of Americans? And he answered, no, sir. What we all now know is a complete lie. There are other lies that the NSA and its top officials have, U.S. government's top officials have told. And by lie, I mean advisedly, things they know to be false that they're saying anyway to convince people of what they want them to believe. Keith Alexander repeatedly said, the head of the NSA, that they are incapable of accounting for the exact number of calls and emails that they intercept from the American telecommunications system, even though the program we ended up exposing, Bounce Informant, counts with exact mathematical precision, exactly the data that he said he's incapable of providing. Or the NSA and the GCHQ have repeatedly said that the purpose of these programs is to protect people from terrorism and to safeguard national security, and that they never, unlike these evil companies, engage in spying for economic reasons. And yet report after report that we field, from spying on the Brazilian oil giant Petrobras, spying on the Organization of American States and economic summits where economic accords were negotiated, to energy companies around the world in Europe and Asia and Latin America, just completely negate these claims, prove that they our lies. And then we have President Obama, who repeatedly says things like, we cannot and do not spy eavesdrop on the communication of Americans without warrants, even though the 2008 law that was enacted by the Congress, of which he was a part, had little purpose other than to empower the U.S. government to eavesdrop on Americans' communication without warrants. And what you see here is serial lying. And yet at the same time, the same media that sees it acts scandalized if you suggest that their claims should not be taken at face value without evidence, because their role is not to be adversarial. Their role is to be loyal spokespeople to those powerful factions that they pretend to exercise oversight. Just one more point on that, which is to understand just how the American and British media function. You can pretty much turn on the TV at any moment or open an internet website and see very brave American journalists calling Edward Snowden a criminal and demanding that he be extradited to the United States and prosecuted and imprisoned. They're very, very brave when it comes to declaring people who are scorned in Washington and who have no power and have become marginalized. They're very brave in condemning them and standing up to them and demanding that the rule of law be applied to them faithfully. He broke the law, he must pay the consequences. And yet, the top national security official of the United States government went to the Senate and lied to their face, as everybody now knows, which is at least as much of a serious crime as anything Edward Snowden is accused of. And you will be hard-pressed to find a single one of those great journalists. You will be very hard-pressed to find even a single one of those brave, intrepid journalist ever even think about, let alone express the idea that Director of National Intelligence James Clapper ought to be subject to the rule of law and be prosecuted and imprisoned for the crimes that he committed, because the role of the U.S. government, of the U.S. media and their British counterparts is to be voices for those with the greatest power and to protect their interests and serve them. And everything that we've done over the last 6 months and everything we've decided in the last month about forming a new media organization is all about trying to subvert that process and reanimate and reinstill the process of journalism for what it was intended to be, which is as a true adversarial force, a check against those with the greatest power. So I just want to close with one last point, which is the nature of the surveillance state that we've reported over the last 6 months. Every time I do an interview, people ask similar questions such as, what is the most significant story that you have revealed? Or what is it that we have learned about the last story that you just published? And what I've really begun saying is that there really is only one overarching point that all of these stories have revealed. And that is, and I say this without the slightest bit hyperbole or melodrama, it's not metaphorical and it's not figurative, it is literally true that the goal of the NSA and its Five Eyes partners in the English-speaking world, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and especially the UK, is to eliminate privacy globally, to ensure that there be no human communications that occur electronically that evades their surveillance net. They want to make sure that all forms of human communication, by telephone or by internet, and all online activities are collected, monitored, stored, and analyzed by that agency and by their allies. That, to describe that is to describe a ubiquitous surveillance state. You don't need hyperbole to make that point, and you don't need to believe me when I say that that's their goal. Document after document within the archive that Edward Snowden provided us, declare that to be their goal. They are obsessed with searching out any small little crevice on the planet where some form of communication might take place without their being able to invade it. One of the stories that we're working on now, I used to get in trouble when I was at The Guardian for previewing my stories. I'm not at The Guardian anymore, so I'm just going to do it anyway, is... The NSA is, and the GCHQ are, they're being driven crazy by the idea that you can go on an airplane and use certain cell phone devices or internet services and be away from their prying eyes for a few hours at a time. They are obsessed with finding ways to invade the systems of online, onboard internet service and mobile phone service, because the very idea that human beings can communicate even for a few moments without them being able to collect and store and analyze and monitor what it is that we're saying is simply intolerable. That is their institutional mandate. And when I get asked questions when I do interviews in different countries, well, why would they want to spy on this official, or why would they want to spy on Sweden, or why would they want to target this company here? The premise of that question is really flawed. The premise of the question is that the NSA and the GCHQ need a specific reason to target somebody for surveillance. That is not how they think. They target every form of communication that they can possibly get their hands on. And if you think about what individual privacy does for us as human beings, let alone what it does for us on a political level, that it really is the thing that lets us explore boundaries and engage in creativity and use the mechanisms of dissent without fear. When you think about a world in which privacy is allowed to be eliminated, you're really talking about eliminating everything that makes it valuable to be a free individual. A surveillance state, by its necessity, by its very existence, breeds conformity, because when beings know that they're always susceptible to being watched, even if they're not always being watched, the choices that they make are far more constrained, are far more limited, cling far more closely to orthodoxy than when they can act in the private realm. And that's precisely why the NSA and the GCHQ and the world's most powerful teams throughout history, and now always as the first goal, have the elimination of privacy at the top of the list, because it's what ensures that human beings can no longer resist the decrees that they're issuing. Well, thank you once again very much. And good.
So, thanks, Glenn. We have a little bit of time for questions. I'll start with one, and that is, what do you think is the motivation behind this? We want to be able to spy on really everyone. So the motivation behind the motivation?
There are some obvious discrete motivations, whether it be the ability to learn what economic competitors are doing, the ability to learn about technological advances in other countries in order to replicate them, the ability to learn what's happening politically and diplomatically in different countries to get better contract negotiations or to be able to better manipulate the world. But ultimately, it really is only one goal, and that goal is power. If you think about what it means to be able to know everything about everybody else in the rest of the world, and this is the key for me, while at the same time, those power factions that know everything about what the rest of the world is doing are building an ever higher and more impenetrable wall of secrecy behind which they operate, the power imbalance is as extreme as it gets. In a healthy society, private individuals have privacy, hence the name privacy, except in the rarest of cases. It's supposed to be public servants, public figures, public agencies that have extreme transparency, except in the most extreme cases, hence the name public sector. And yet we've completely reversed that so that we as private individuals have almost no privacy, and they as public figures, public servants, public officials, have almost no transparency. And that ultimately is what this surveillance system is about, is accumulating more and more power by being able to know everything about those over whom they're ruling, while those over whom they're ruling know virtually nothing about them. You know, ultimately, governments will do two things. They will, in the first instance, do everything that they can to advance their own interests. And governments around the world, especially in the West, don't perceive it to be in their own interests, at least some of them, to disobey the United States. And they also don't perceive it to be in their own interest to take meaningful action against surveillance policies which they themselves believe in and engage in. And so the question then becomes, how do you get them to do something beyond that framework? And the only real answer becomes to increase the cost to doing it. As I said earlier, I think that the cost to the internet sector in the United States has become quite real. The cost to Boeing, which just lost a $4 billion contract for fighter jets because Brazil didn't want to buy from a country that has been systematically spying on them, is very real. I think it's up to all of us to devise ways to not persuade them, because I don't think that power centers get persuaded in that way by nice, lofty arguments. I think it's important to devise ways to raise the cost severely for either their active participation in or their acquiescence to the systematic erosion of our privacy rights. And when we find the way to put them in the position where it's not we who are in fear of them, but they who are in fear of us, that's when these policies will change.
Investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald giving the keynote address to the 30C3 Chaos Communications Conference. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And finally, we hear cryptography and cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier Speaking recently to the Internet Engineering Task Force about NSA surveillance keywords and corporate collusion with universal digital surveillance.
Good morning. So my favorite part about all of this are the code names. Most recent one we got was Muscular, which is the NSA code name for getting traffic out of Google, Yahoo, probably others, by exploiting links between their data centers. This is different from their program of getting data, exploiting the links from the users to the servers, which we don't know a code name for, or Prism, which is the program of getting that same data by asking the companies directly. The generic name that we're using for a lot of this collecting data on the fiber is Upstream. My guess is that's not a code name, but it includes a lot of code names, usually different companies. Fairview, Blarney, that's AT&T, Oakstar, Little is Level 3 Communications, Remedy is BT, there are lots of those. Quantum is the NSA code name for packet injection attacks from the backbone. This runs on things that are called tumult, turbulence, turmoil. I can't tell if those are three different generations or different types. Another cool code name is FoxAcid. FoxAcid is an exploit orchestrator, which is basically like Metasploit with a budget. Different exploits that FoxAcid can serve include Validator, United Rake, and also my nomination for stupidest code name, Egotistical Giraffe. There are lots more. The particular exploit that you get is determined by what I think is one of the most cool code names, Ferret Cannon. And in addition to those exploits that just own machines, there are various implants that do different things. Blackheart, Mineralize, Highlands, Vagrant. Data when collected is dropped into a variety of analysis tools, Marina, Pinwhale, Mainway, XKeyscore, lots more. Right, Bull Run is the NSA's program for subverting security products, right, covertly inserting backdoors. And there's a lot more. There's a lot more I haven't done. There's a lot more to come. The basic takeaway here is that the NSA has turned the internet into a giant surveillance platform. Right, this is robust. It is robust politically. It is robust legally. And it is robust technically. There's a lot of details we don't know. And there's a lot we're never going to know. Right, details on cryptography, near as I can tell, are not in the documents. Company names are largely not in the documents. Right, this is ECI, which is extremely compartmented information that basically means it's not written down. So we're probably not going to know which products have been subverted. In some ways, that's okay. I mean, knowing the details, I think, is going to lead us to chase yesterday's problems. And the real issue is to understand and fix today's and especially tomorrow's problems. Right, so what are the trends here? I think it's important to understand how we got here. Right, fundamentally, data is a byproduct of the information society. All computer processes produce data. Right, this data is being increasingly stored and increasingly searched, simply because of Moore's Law. It is cheaper to save it than to throw it away. Right, this is exacerbated by cloud computing. This is exacerbated by user devices where the vendor controls a lot more. And the results are what we know. Right? Wholesale surveillance, surveillance backwards in time, the loss of ephemeral conversation, systems that never forget. Right? And this is not a question of malice on anybody's part. This is the way computers work. So what we've ended up with is basically a public-private surveillance partnership. There's a basic alliance of government and corporate interests. Right, NSA surveillance largely piggybacks on corporate capabilities through cooperation, through bribery, through threats, through compulsion. Right, fundamentally, surveillance is the business model of the internet. Right, the NSA didn't wake up and say, let's just spy on everybody. They looked up and said, wow, corporations are spying on everybody. Let's get ourselves a copy. And this is not one of the arguments I hear again and again is it's only metadata. Right? Metadata equals surveillance. Right? Metadata is extraordinarily important. Do the thought experiment. If you hire a private detective to eavesdrop on somebody, you know what he'll do? He'll put a bug in their room, in their car. He'll tap their phone. Right? He'll get the conversations. You hire that same private detective to surveil somebody, You get a report, where he went, who he spoke to, what he purchased, what he read. That's all metadata. Metadata equals surveillance. Right, so when the President Obama says it's only metadata, he's really saying you're all only under surveillance. Right? And this is not just about the NSA. Right? We have an extraordinary window into the NSA's activities, but this is also the FBI, the CIA. Right? This is what any well-funded nation-state adversary would do. The United States has a privileged position on the internet, which allows it to do more, and it has enormous budget, but we know that other countries do the same things. And we also know that technology democratizes. Right? Today's secret NSA programs becomes tomorrow's PhD thesis, becomes the next year's high school science fair projects. Right? So we have a choice. We have a choice of an internet that is vulnerable to all attackers or an internet that is secure for all users. Right? We have made surveillance too cheap, and we need to make it more expensive. Now, there's good news, bad news. Edward Snowden said in the first interview after his documents became public, he said, encryption works. Properly implemented strong crypto systems are one of the few things that you can rely on. Right? We know this is true. This is a lesson from the NSA's attempts to break Tor. They can't do it, and it pisses them off. This is the lessons of the NSA's attempt to collect contact lists from the internet backbone. If you saw the data, they got about 10 times as much information from Yahoo users than from Google users, even though I'm sure the ratio of users is probably the reverse. The reason? Google uses SSL by default. Yahoo does not. Right? This is the lessons from Muscular. You look at the slides, they deliberately targeted the data where SSL wasn't protecting it. Right? Encryption works. The bad news is Snowden's next sentence in that same interview. He said, unfortunately, endpoint security is so terrifically weak that the NSA can frequently find ways around it. Right? Encryption works, but it's hard to get it to work. What I wrote when I was writing about this is that the math works, but math has no agency. All right, so what does this mean? We do know that there is some piece of cryptanalysis that the NSA has that we don't. Right? The NSA makes a huge investment in mathematics, and presumably it's not all wasted. In the black budget that was released, DNI James Clapper has a quote. He said, we are investing in groundbreaking cryptographic capabilities to defeat adversarial cryptography and exploit internet traffic. That doesn't sound like we're hiring a bunch of mathematicians and hope we get lucky. Right? That sounds like we have something at the edge of practicality, and we're investing to make it practical. We don't know what that is. We're likely not to. I have a few guesses. First one is elliptic curves. It's perfectly reasonable that they have some advances that we don't in elliptic curve cryptography. Either generic techniques to break it quicker, or classes of curves that they know about that if they can steer us to use, they have an advantage. The second are general factoring and discrete log advances. I mean, we in the academic community get advances every few years, assume they're a decade or so ahead. The third is a practical attack against RC4. And my ordering of these changes, depending on what day it is. But those are my guesses. A long shot of something against AES. I really doubt it, but I wouldn't put it beyond possibility. But we do know that most of how the NSA breaks cryptography is by getting around it. Right? They exploit bad implementations. They exploit default or weak keys. They deliberately insert backdoors in encryption products. And they have a group that exfiltrates keys, which means stealing them. And that is primarily how they break cryptography. So solutions here are varied. And I think they necessarily are. There is not one solution that's going to solve this. First, I think there are going to be some internal self-corrections. But as amazing as it seems, the NSA had no contingency plans in place for their secrets being completely and totally leaked. Right, it took them 2 months to come up with a viable response. Right, that's over. And I think the cost-benefit analysis has changed. I mean, the NSA is going to have to incorporate the risk of exposure when they decide whether to exploit something or not. Right? The nature of secrecy is changing. The internet has done that. And I think everything they do will eventually become public. Right? This wouldn't be a problem if the Snowden documents said the NSA was spying on North Korea and the Taliban. Right? It said they were spying on Belgium. Or I guess that the UK was spying on Belgium, which I guess is like Connecticut spying on Nebraska. Right? Corporations also have a new cost-benefit analysis. Right? Pre-Snowden, there was no cost to cooperate because your cooperation would be secret. Now, companies have to assume that it'll be public. There's been huge losses of sales, mostly foreign, hardware manufacturers, software, cloud providers. Right? And there is a PR benefit in fighting, and more companies are realizing that. You know, and oddly, near as I can tell, the NSA doesn't weigh the costs and benefits of their programs. In some ways, it's not surprising because the TSA doesn't either. But I'm always amazed when I just don't see the cost-benefit analyses. Anyway, I think that's going to happen internal to NSA regardless. There's also going to be external self-corrections. There's been enormous political blowback to the NSA surveillance. Right? In the United States, that's where the political pushback is happening. And I think this will limit what the NSA does. Right? To a lesser extent, the effectiveness of bulk collection has been challenged. The previous NSA directors, I mean, both General Alexander and General Harding, have been of the attitude of collect everything. And it's not obvious that this is effective for a whole bunch of reasons. There are limitations of intelligence, I mean, fundamental limitations of what we can get for intelligence, a lot of examples, but it really seems like a lot of what the NSA is getting is pure voyeurism. There's not a lot we can do about it. And remember, the NSA has a dual mission. I mean, they're charged with protecting communications and exploiting communications. And more these missions are coming into conflict. Post 9/11, the exploiting side won completely. I think there's going to be some natural rebalancing as our fear subsides. So that's inside the government. There are a lot of technical things we can do. The goal is to make eavesdropping expensive. Right? That's the way to think of it. To force the NSA to abandon wholesale collection in favor of targeted collection. So ubiquitous encryption on the internet backbone. That will do an enormous amount of good. Provide some real security. Right, cover traffic for those who need to use encryption. But the more you can encrypt data as it flows around the internet, the better we'll do. Second, target dispersal. We were safer when our email was at 10,000 ISPs than when it's at 10. Right? Fundamentally, it makes it easier for the NSA and others to collect. So anything to disperse targets makes sense. Right? Usable application layer encryption. And there's a lot here. I mean, the lessons of PGP are, you know, one-click encryption is too hard. Right? On the other hand, OTR is doing great, and so is disk encryption. More open standards, more open source. These are harder to subvert. More endpoint security. The NSA name for these are PSPs, personal security products, and they irritate them a lot. So the more we can do, the better. Better integrated anonymity tools. And really, assurance. This is a hard one. This is an important one. Right? We need some way to guarantee, to determine, to be, have some confidence that the software we have does what it's supposed to do and nothing else. Right? The goals here is to leverage the economics, leverage the physics, leverage the math. Right? The NSA has a big budget, but they are not magical. Right, they have the same limitations as everybody else. It largely, though, this is a political problem. Right, and the political solutions are stuff we know: transparency, oversight, accountability, no surprise. Right, we know the problems, laws have lagged technology. General Hyden talked about this in some interview maybe a year ago. What he said is, give me a box and I'll operate to the very edges of that box. Right, tell me the law and I'll operate right up to the law. The problem is, when laws lag technology, there's increasing empty space in this rapidly growing box. Right? I'm not sure how we fix that, but I think we need to think about it. Right? And there are laws that are going through the books. My worry is the ones that are being talked about now are just point solutions. right? They solve individual programs and individual authorities, and they won't actually change anything. The other problem, of course, is that reigning in the U.S., the NSA only affects the United States, right? Mostly doesn't affect non-U.S. persons, right? Fundamentally, any law the U.S. passes is going to completely ignore any international persons, right? Doesn't affect the actions of other countries. And this is really an arms race. We haven't heard this, but we're going to. You can't rein in the NSA because if you do, China wins, right? That's the arms race talking. It's a zero-sum game, and it's us versus them. I mean, long term, we need to get everyone to understand that a secure internet is in everyone's best interest. That is not us versus them. That it's a secure internet versus a vulnerable internet. Right? That turns a zero-sum game into a positive-sum game and actually makes political solutions possible. So once you do that, you have laws and treaties to support it, you have technologies to support the legal regime, and you have laws and technologies to deal with non-compliant actors.
Crypto cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier, speaking recently at a conference of the Internet Engineering Task Force. And that concludes today's NSA Monitoring edition of Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. We welcome your comments, leaks, suggestions, and ideas with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.